Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS Viewed, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. Now, today's episode is a little different than most of them because, you know, for one, you know, Jim's here, Curtis is here. They're going to be gone next. I think it's next week they'll be out. So yes, we'll have a couple of special guests that I'm not going to reveal ahead of time because I want you, the listeners, to stay here for that. But, you know,
hopefully you're not bringing in a dog or something like that. You bring any pets?
No, just no talking animals, none of that kind of stuff. So, so of course I'm Adam Lowther, and then Jim Petrosky and Curtis McGiffin is here this week. But one of the things we're doing differently, we normally sort of talk articles and strategic issues, and it tends to be sort of international security, regional studies, nuclear weapons. But today we've got a different topic. So I talked to Jim before, you know, a day or two ago, and I said, hey, Jim, for this week, let's do a topic that is more up your alley. And so Jim said, you know what? I've got a topic. And of course, the topic is based off an article, but it's a science topic. Now, Jim will not break out any equations, but he is going to talk about whether some... he does have a calculator.
I did bring my calculator, and it's an RPN, reverse Polish notation calculator. For those of you scientists among us, you know that's the only way to do science.
So it's an article that was in, I think it's Popular Engineering or Interesting Engineering. And it says, China's non-nuclear hydrogen bomb generates fireball to burn targets at 1,800 degrees, according to a report. And, of course, it's talking about a new weapon that the Chinese have supposedly developed. And it's supposed to be this awesome new thing that is a conventional weapon. It's not nuclear, but it's a conventional hydrogen bomb that's supposed to do all kinds of great things to destroy those evil invading Americans should they set foot on China's sovereign territory in the East China Sea or the South China Sea.
I'm not sure that's why they're building it.
I'm pretty confident it is. It's for the Americans. But I also read, you've distracted me already, that the Chinese have also put a megawatt laser in space. That was another article that was out here recently. So how much of this stuff is true, I don't know, but I will throw it over to you, Jim, on our hydrogen bomb, non-nuclear hydrogen bomb. So is this real? Is this, you know, propaganda? What are we looking at here? What's the reality of this?
Thank you. First of all, to give credit where credit is due, Curtis actually found this article and shot it at me and said, is this true? Because I saw the headline, I don't have it here, but it basically, China has tested a hydrogen bomb, which I just thought was the coolest art. Like, okay, here we go, testing back. And I love when nuclear weapon systems are being developed because it provides new capabilities. I just wished they were ours, not theirs, in new capabilities. But let's first talk a little bit, because I think it's going to be different, but in the end, we're going to go back to the same. We're going to talk about nuclear weapons, because I think it ties in here. So first, an intention getter, hydrogen bomb. So what does it really mean? Well, they've developed a bomb. It's basically like our thermobaric bombs, like the Moab bomb, which is basically a bomb that is designed to release some sort of some propellant into the air with a first explosion and disperse it over a large area. And then a secondary explosion ignites that propellant and it explodes. And it explodes very quickly. And so what they're using is they're using a form of hydrogen that's solid. And it basically explodes in the air, disperses that hydrogen fuel everywhere, the secondary explosion, then, of course, ignites the hydrogen. So for those in the audience that are worried, it's not going to turn into a nuclear bomb, and we'll tell you why in the end. But I'm going to hold that right now. But right now, the fuel is hydrogen, and it burns very well. And so it essentially burns. If you want to think about it, I did a little bit of study, a little bit of background on this. Actually, one of the courses I talk specifically about these thermobaric bombs, because what's interesting about them is they don't put out a lot of shrapnel like a normal, you know, dumb bomb would do, or a typical missile or a conventional explosive would do. But what they do is they produce a very rapid, very, very rapid expansion of air that's highly heated over top of its target. And it does two things. It overheats the target and it puts a pressure wave on the target. For those that have taken my classes, those things may sound familiar because I talk about nuclear effects, which is blast, overpressure, shock, thermal, electromagnetic, and radiation and dust, or better known as...
You bastard.
You got it. It's bastard. And so all the conventional weapons give us these same things, blast, overpressure, and shock, and that's what this weapon does. It provides a way of delivering blast, overpressure, and shock. And now the question is, well, then what's new here? There's not really anything new here. Well, what's new is the fact that this weapon, from again looking at it from a scientific standpoint and looking at it from a nuclear weapon standpoint, it has to do with two things. It has to do with temperature, and it has to do with the rapid or the speed at which we have burned. So let's just talk a little bit. I'm going to pull a Curtis here because Curtis always pulls out the facts. So since this is my opportunity, I'm going to pull out some facts for you. Okay, so if we have a gasoline bomb, it burns basically at, I'm going to put this all in Fahrenheit. So around 1800 Fahrenheit, it burns. Okay, if you do an alcohol, and this is now talking to Adam here. If you burn alcohol, which you like to do, it burns at around 3,500 Fahrenheit. Okay, and if you put hydrogen in the air, it burns at 3,700 Fahrenheit. So it burns at a much, much higher temperature. And that's the one fact that makes it really good. By the way, wood burns at about 1,600 Fahrenheit. So it just gives you some idea that hydrogen, it burns hotter. And so the Chinese in this weapon that they supposedly have built are building a weapon that has very, very high temperatures designed to burn things on the ground. But that's only the first step. And you may remember, if you've taken any of my classes or listened to any of my discussions on weapons effects, it's not just the energy, it's also the speed at which it releases it. And this is the most important piece. So for hydrogen, we normally talk about, am I going too scientific here, Adam or Curtis? I just need to know.
No, not yet.
Not yet? Oh, okay.
Dozing yet.
Okay, well, good. I'll give you a calculator to start calculating things on, Curtis, if you need. All right. So then the other exciting piece is you got to think about why this weapon's so important. The other piece of this is that it also burns at a very high rate. Most people don't say this. The articles don't say it. But I started thinking about, why would you do this? Just to, you know, this didn't make sense just to make a new weapon and call it a hydrogen bomb. Well, that's pretty cool. I'm going to threaten you with a hydrogen bomb. But anyway, if we look at gasoline, again, using gasoline, it burns, and typically we talk about how fast it burns in terms of speed, how, you know, the speed at which the wave it's creating. And so gas burns at, you know, roughly millimeters per second. Okay, that's not terribly fast. If you get alcohol, especially ethanol alcohol, it burns at about 400 millimeters per second. So it burns much, much faster. Okay, and so you get a larger shock wave, you get a larger pressure wave, and for the same amount of energy. For wood, it's like 0.022 millimeters per second because it burns very slowly, which is good because I burn wood in my stove. By the way, Curtis asked me about this cut on my face, and I was telling him that, you know, when I was out back of my house, I was going to chop some wood, but I needed more energy. So I went over to my portable nuclear reactor and I was tightening the wrench on top of the pressure piece. And I actually slipped with a wrench and hit my face. That's why I have a scratch on the side of my face. Okay, back to the...
See the other guy.
Yeah, and that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. But the hydrogen, so I said wood burns at 0.2 millimeters, and gasoline is about a millimeter per second. But hydrogen burns at 3,000 millimeters per second. It's extremely rapid in the way that it builds that pressure wave. And so just like nuclear bombs, that create a huge pressure wave, even for the same amount of energy, this hydrogen bomb will do the same. And so it can damage, it can, the blast is higher, the overpressure, especially you get over top of a target, is higher, and the shock is incredibly high, which is why they say in this article, it can break, melt and break weapons or break equipment, and it can shock the ground to be used as an aerial target. So that's my scientific evaluation of why you would create this hydrogen bomb and the new lethality that it would add to the battlefield that is sort of related to something between a conventional weapon and, you know, and between there and then you go to the MOAB and now this hydrogen weapon, if it's supposedly there. I haven't looked at weights and masses. That would be the other trade-off, but I haven't had a chance to look at that because they're using, hydrogen, or using a solid
magnesium hydride.
Yeah. So magnesium also burns very hot too. So magnesium hydride. So magnesium burns about 2800 Fahrenheit. So you get really extended burns with this. Almost, you know, you can think of it like a phosphorus bomb on steroids. So if personnel in the open, yeah, bad news. Okay. So there you
go.
Now
they're saying this is a 4.5 pound bomb. 4.5 pounds, but yet the pictures they've shown is, you know, it almost looks like a nuclear weapon with 4.5 pounds of a conventional explosive, which that's, you know, not accurate, correct? Or incorrect?
I do not. There's no way. I saw the pictures. I tried to do some background reading. I don't agree that it's a 4.5 pound bomb, or they send it out as a group of bomblets, which would give you an aerial target, because and that's what I think it is. So, I'm pontificating. This is opinion, not fact. Everything else I gave you was fact and true and absolutely accurate. And you can't question me because I'm a scientist. So, in the pictures they showed, I believe, and in the discussion, it says it gives them the ability to make a larger or a smaller aerial target. And I believe they do that with a bunch of bomblets that are held in these 4 pound bomblets, which would make a lot of sense for a bomb of that type. So that would be my guess in there. And if anyone in our audience wish to take umbrage with me or know something better than me, nids@thinkdeterrence.com, and tell me I'm wrong, and I'll come on a future show and tell them that somebody corrected me. All right, there you go.
So, you know, it's interesting. It sort of makes me think to a similar or related topic. And I was looking at, I think it was Visual Capitalist. I don't know if you've ever heard of Visual Capitalist. Mm-hmm. They do great. I get their daily, you know, their daily graph or whatever. And a day or two ago, they had AI patents. And the Chinese were something akin to 80% of the world's AI-related patents. And so I guess I wonder, it makes me sort of wonder, are the Chinese ahead of us in sort of new nuclear technologies, whether, you know, not only just nuclear, but conventional weapons technologies? I mean, that you see a lot of the scientific literature, Jim. Are they sort of, you know, we considered ourselves the best in this field, in the nuclear engineering, chemistry, you know, the weapons physics. Are the Chinese, have they caught us? Are they passing us? You know, I mean, you see the open literature and all of the patents that they're pursuing. You know, what can we make out of, you know, this and, you know, the quantity? I don't know whether it's quality, but the quantity of, you know, the patents and, you know, research articles that they're producing.
Yeah, well, again, the Chinese talking about patents is like asking me to talk about the speed limit. So I'm sorry, don't quote me on that. But anyway, the point is that they don't follow the patented, you know, the world patenting as it is. That's one of the problems we have with dealing with them. So that's just a sidebar. Are they ahead of us? I don't know if they're ahead of us, but what they do show, and I do think it's very important, is that they're able to explore and put things out very quickly in the test phase, in the analysis phase, that we don't tend to do. Whether we're doing it or not behind the scenes, I don't know. I'm not in the conventional weapons side of development, but we don't tend to tell people that we have new weapons. I mean, the MOAB only came out, you know, became popularized. We started using it sort of in Iraq. I think we used it once in the down in Arkansas or where down at Redstone Arsenal. And then after that, we sort of, you know, sort of hid behind not using it anywhere for quite some time. And so I think what China is doing is I think this is more, again, of the messaging that China gives us. Here's another whack-a-mole for you to have to deal with, to worry about, without having to go through all the treaty regimes and everything else, patent, you know, whatever, in order to develop that. And we don't see that. So in my assessment, that's the piece that I think is more worrisome. They're more than willing to do what, you know, what Russia does with their nuclear weapons, use them every day and say, look, we have nuclear weapons. You know, don't mess with us. They're out there saying we're building new capabilities. Don't mess with us. And that, I don't like that kind of messaging. We need to do the same kind of message in reverse, saying, yep, well, we have whatever that new thing is. And we'll talk maybe a little bit about it from the hydrogen bomb standpoint. Curtis, you had a, did I sort of answer your question, Adam? Because there's sensitivities.
Yeah,
here.
I mean,
get into on the capes.
Yeah. Side. I mean, you just wonder, given the focus they've put on some of these core technologies, quantum computing, artificial mm-hmm. intelligence, you know, nuclear technologies, and you know, they're actually building and building new systems and new delivery systems and new warheads. And, you know, is this focus on it, giving them the opportunity to do new modern science that is giving them an advantage over us?
Yeah. Well, obviously they do take advantage of that, their process for getting things out, their innovation, and their and displaying that innovation up front. So are they getting ahead of us? Well, of course, if you come out with AI and the first thing we say about AI is, oh, we should sign a treaty saying we're not going to do anything with AI. Oh, well, we're going into space. Yeah, but we're going to make a treaty saying we're not going to go into space with any weapons. Well, you know, after a while, you know, you've hamstrung yourself so much. And that's the problem with all the new capabilities. We tend to put the rules in place before we even know what the capabilities are going to do. And you see that, but China is not held back by that. In fact, they use that as a tool, and I think it's a good messaging tool. I don't like it, but it's a good messaging tool coming from China. We're willing to try out new things.
So is your premise then that their new megawatt laser is in fact, as it was described, the Death Star? Is that what you're telling me then?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure the Death Star. There's all kinds of physics in the Death Star description. But the megawatt laser, I haven't looked into it, but I mean, megawatt lasers, the problem with a megawatt laser in space is where do you store the power and how do you store it efficiently and how do you keep it there? Because that's a lot of power that you're going to release in a very, very short time. And that problem is a very difficult problem in space. I mean, it's like anything else holding in space. I mean, we think about a battery, a taser. You know, you store up that energy in a taser and then you release it really shortly. Well, imagine megawatts of energy stored somewhere in space. Over time, you can gain it, but you still have to store it. So you could put a weapon in space for 100 years and gain 100 years of solar energy and store it somewhere. But where are you going to store it where it won't collapse either by, you know, if it's electrical, you know, short circuiting, if it's conventional decaying in terms of, you know, chemical decay or radioactive decay, all those things happen. You know, the world's not that easy to hold on to that energy. That's why we typically build lasers and weapon systems close to the energy source for exactly that reason.
Yeah, I just wonder how much of what we're hearing about, because a lot of it's in the foreign press. It's not being reported in the American press. And so I wonder how much of it is real, how much of it is hyperbole. I mean, you guys have, Curtis, I think maybe you brought this up not long ago, a month or so, where, you know, the Chinese said, well, we have the ability to detect the magnetic fields propagated around ballistic missile submarines. And so therefore now we can track all American submarines. And of course, this would be for the Chinese, this would be ideal for them, but whether it's actually true or not is one of those things where I can't say for sure. So how much of all this stuff is real and how much of it is aspirational?
Yeah. Well, being an engineer, I can honestly say you got to tie the engineering to the physics and then the application, and usually it's where it falls apart. I mean, you know, again, can you make a megawatt laser? Sure. Can you put it in space and hold the power and use it in a power system? That's a different problem. We'll have to look at it. That would be good for a show in the future. I want to give Curtis a chance. He always
gets it. Sounds like you've done the show already.
we're done. We'll see you later. No, go ahead, Curtis.
Well, let me give my 2 cents on this, because let's all make the assumption that this is accurate. I'm not surprised that it's not in American media. This is not a story that American media wants to tell. So here's 3 thoughts that I want to, you know, share with you all in the audience. The first one is that, assuming this is true, and it sounds to me like Jim says this is physically capable.
Yeah.
What this demonstrates is China's willingness, right, to derive new and deadly weapons even below the nuclear threshold. You know, America made a big deal during the war on terror, Adam, if you remember, building small diameter bombs so we could drop little bombs to minimize collateral damage. China's not really concerned about that. They're going to build bigger bombs for whatever needs that they have. And I'll come back to that. But what this does is it gives them freedom to maneuver. They do not feel that they are somehow or should be restricted by any sort of human or heuristic love, right? So there just isn't that. There isn't a desire to kill as few people as possible when you build these kinds of weapons. Let me go to the second point. If this is true, and Adam, you were like, well, they're really using it for, I think you said something along the lines of, I think they're using this to get Americans, right, to keep us. This is really about Taiwan. Okay, well, sure. So this system is designed, it's different from the Russian thermobaric vacuum bombs that they've been using in Ukraine. Those are very, very destructive because of the overpressure that they create. These are like 40% less of that overpressure. And with this extra heating effect, and they're saying that, you know, so the difference between the nanoseconds or the microseconds to 2 seconds of heat and flash is apparently a game changer in its ability to burn, melt, and otherwise
sear. Maybe things like American warships, potentially?
Sure. Light things on fire, these sorts of things, in order to create damage. But without all the overpressure that destroys buildings and infrastructure. The goal here for these bombs is to kill Taiwanese, not destroy their buildings and infrastructure, without using a nuke. Okay? And so this is what I think is the real dastardly thing about this, is that this is really designed to effectuate an invasion of Taiwan. That's why the timing of this weapon is such that it is. And it also has a coercive threat to it, right? It looks scary. It's a terror weapon. So that is totally uncoupled to any treaties, even if China were to, to agree to one. And so let me give to the third one, which is, this is yet another example of both intent and resolve to settle the Taiwan question in their favor.
And quickly.
Yes. And so whether or not they want to use nuclear weapons, all of these new weapons that they're building that we've talked about ad nauseum on various podcasts in the past, or maybe they decide they don't have to go there and they want to use these super conventionals. That's what I'm going to call them. Novel, conventional, super conventionals. That they can sort of have a similar effect without all of the damage, but without all of the international condemnation that would go along with using a nuclear weapon. So China's thinking beyond. They're thinking about, after we've taken Taiwan, what do we do here? And so the last thing I'll say here is part of this third response is that I don't think with these kinds of weapons that the CCP is interested in sparing the Taiwan people in order to re-educate them. It is only interested in extinguishing their democracy and thus their culture, but keeping the prize, which is all the infrastructure. This is why we should be concerned about weapons like this.
Yeah, but correct me if I'm wrong, Jim. Doesn't this actual weapon would destroy all of those factories and would destroy that equipment? And so it wouldn't just kill the Taiwanese people. It'd destroy everything.
Yeah, the overpressure. So when you get the overpressure, let me answer that. But before I do that, Curtis, you hit my point number five, and I'm going to go back to it. And my point number seven, as I'm going through my list, I just thought I'd give you guys a chance to cue those up. Thank you. But anyway, your answer to your question, Adam, is yeah, the overpressure of these weapons would be very high. So these large factory buildings are extremely subjective to high overpressure. You can think of how like a Walmart, you know, here in the north here, especially when it snows hard, the Walmart roof collapses under the pressure of the snow on it because they're highly susceptible to that, because they're large flat surfaces that you get lots of pressure onto those. So those kind of things would be destroyed. However, if they're distributing them in these smaller bombs, to Curtis' point maybe, is that you could distribute them in ways that they wouldn't destroy those. I mean, you have a lot of selectivity here if this is done this way. And that's sort of why I held on to I thought about your answer before that, but I wanted to hear, you know, sort of where we went around this is if these are smaller bomblets, you could tailor these unlike large nuclear weapons, which is what China has, to take out smaller regions. This gives them an opportunity to pick an area to fight in. So yes, you could take out large facilities, but if your goal was to take out people or take out smaller infrastructure, you could tailor these bombs to be dropped in a way that they would, you know, burn and crush things outdoors, like automobiles and power lines and such, residential buildings perhaps, and leave the larger buildings alone. I don't know. That's just, you know, one theoretical view. And in fact, you know, I could see this as being these being used as an opening salvo to take over Taiwan, using the nuclear weapons to hold people like nations like the United States back. So you always have that still in your back pocket.
There's no doubt about that. That's definitely the strategy.
Yeah. So that becomes part of the strategy. I want to hit the other piece about the temperature though. And this is really important. And I left this off because I talk about this in my nuclear weapons courses, but it becomes relevant here. The other piece about these weapons is because they spread out the hydrogen over a very large area, not only does it burns fast, so you get a full burn and a full overpressure, so you can sort of selectively choose the area, but it burns for a longer period of time. Okay. And I was going to step out, but then I thought, no, you guys would think I left and, you know, close the show. But I was going to step out and grab an iron, which I should have brought in. If you take a standard iron, and I always ask people this, you take a standard, you know, iron that you iron your clothes with, and you turn it on full, and I say, can you touch this iron? All of you both of you would say, sure, I can touch the iron. And you stick your finger out, you touch it real quickly because the time of contact is very low. For the same temperature, though, if I said, okay, I'll stick your hand against it for 5 minutes, it's a different story. And you get different results. So it's not just the heat, but it's also the latency on that causes things to combust. And so that is the problem that you have here. It mimics many of the effects we get with nuclear weapons. Don't forget, Nagasaki and Hiroshima, what was the number one cause of death?
The fire.
The fires. Okay, things burst into flames and people died from burning or inhaling smoke. And so you have this other problem that you get all these nuclear kinds of things without having to go through any treaties, without having to go. You get to keep your nukes in your back pocket and you get to do everything you want to do. And then you say, oh, by the way, I still have my nukes in my back pocket. And this was the strategic side of this. So get away from the scientific side of it. But you can see how this becomes an interesting, lucrative weapon if you do that. Or if you do want to take, you know, if you decide, well, the heck with it, I'm just going to flatten the buildings in Taiwan. You could do that. You could do that as a demonstration. You know, flatten a semiconductor plant and then say, I'm serious. So, I mean, there's
strategic options. Do we not have this capability? I mean, this doesn't seem to be particularly challenging.
There's some challenging parts with dispersing the material in a way that you get an effect that's, You remember, when you drop a bomb, you don't want to just drop it and have it explode and do all kinds of things. You have an effect that you want. So I believe if we do have it, I don't know that we do or don't. This is the first I heard of it when Curtis wrote it and gave it to me. And again, I saw H-bomb, so I was all excited. But anyway, because that's what I do whenever I see H-bomb. But anyway, first I've seen it. I don't know if the U.S. has it. I'm sure we're looking at it. I mean, we've looked at this. I mean, in Vietnam, we dropped
napalm.
The napalm was burning when it hit the ground with the secondary explosive. But we also had some other bunker busters that were made.
They were bombs that were designed to clear out big swaths of jungle.
Yeah. Take out the jungle.
Create instant landing pads.
RDX and aluminum mixed together. So, and if you think about it, shredded aluminum burns very well once it's, very small. It's very, very burnable and very hot. So we've experienced this. We've explored this. But I haven't seen anything in the U.S. literature that says we're doing this. It's an interesting problem. Again, I look at it from a messaging standpoint. Is we are willing to find that in-between piece that gives us a sweet spot to meet our mission, which goes back to what Curtis said. You find a mission space, and rather than saying, hey, there's AI, let's put a bunch of restrictions on it so we can't use it the way we want to use it. The Chinese go the other way around. They say, what's the mission? And here's the thing that can do it. Let's get it out there and show everyone that we can do it and let them know we're willing to take the mission on. That's the message I got from this storyline.
Well, I would say to this, Adam, as well, just to end to Jim, is to say that while this bomb does not violate any treaties, it probably would violate law of armed conflict, at least from an American or a Western perspective. And, of course, our adversaries aren't necessarily if you're using it to target civilians and you're trying to destroy or kill or anti-urban warfare is essentially what some of these articles are saying that this is primarily for. And I think it could be any of that. That's one of the things it could be used for. Then I think that you're running into these kinds of challenges. Of course, the moment you try to invade another sovereign country, like, an invasion of Taiwan, you're kind of skirting the legal edges here anyway, right? So you're not really necessarily overly concerned, again, about the humanity side of war. This is about victory, total war to some degree, and it is about victory and achieving it as quickly as possible. A tactic, nonetheless, that has been tried and true throughout history. But in the end, the victor has to live with what has occurred there. And you think about the firebombing of Japan, the firebombing of Tokyo, Dresden, places like that, much, much worse than those killed in Nagasaki and Hiroshima as far as the death counts. We can't discount, these kinds of what these kinds of weapons do. And this is why deterrence is so important. It isn't just about deterring a nuclear attack, like most minimalists believe. It is about deterring this kind of war. It is about deterring the kind of war that not only is catastrophic, but can be existential in its own right. And as far as Taiwan's concerned, an attempted invasion of Taiwan by China would be existential for them.
Oh, yeah. Unquestionably. Yeah.
Even without a nuke.
Aren't you, Curtis, aren't you ethnically Wallachian? I mean, maybe nobody remembers Wallachia, but it was once a sovereign country that now no longer exists. So, by the way, the Polish have been partitioned and ceased to exist as a nation 3 times. So existential threats are real. People.
That's right. Yeah, I haven't met a Prussian recently, so I'm very interested.
Yeah, well, that's a different story. Unification of Germany. They got to take the Bavarians and all the other Germans under their wing. But we've used up our time for this one. Jim, you got like 5 seconds.
Yeah, 5 seconds. No, I'm going to take a few more because I did a little bit of a marketing on this article. And I asked a few people that are not in our sphere about this H-bomb article. And the first question I got back, I just want to put it to rest before we're done here, is, oh, it's an H-bomb. So if they have hydrogen there, can it become a nuclear weapon? It's just worth mentioning that the hydrogen is just regular hydrogen. Nuclear bombs, although they're called hydrogen bombs, they use a form of hydrogen that is not natural, called deuterium, which has an extra neutron, and tritium, which has two extra neutrons. And because of the tritium and the deuterium, they are able to fuse together. And so this cannot be mistaken for a nuclear weapon, or cannot become a nuclear weapon, in at least what the article says it was designed to do or be. I just always like to separate that out, because very hard to keep the words clear when they're all the same words. You know, hydrogen bomb, hydrogen bomb. Well, what do you mean? So I like using the word nuclear bomb. It just makes it clear all the time. And with that, I'll turn it over back to our audience for that science. Oh, no,
come on. Let's remember, hydrogen has a history, right? Yeah. Wasn't the Hindenburg.
That wasn't a bomb.
But it was a hydrogen fire. Yeah. And what was the commentary as it burned? Oh, the humanity of it. Mm-hmm. And so here we see this correlation once again, and possibly. And so, again, I just think that this is something that we need to be concerned about. You're right. It's not a nuclear weapon, but it might be the next best thing.
Has all a right. lot of great features.
All right. Well, we are out of time, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up. So thanks to Jim and Curtis for having this great discussion. Of course, thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us. And as always, we want to remind you to not only go listen to more of Curtis, or, you know, see what his thoughts are on X, but I think Jim's got some new nuclear knowledges that he's putting out. We've got, you know, some of our NIDS events coming up. We've got lots of great stuff that are going on. So come to the website, check it out. And if you want to be subscribed to the NIDS Insider, it's a monthly report we're putting out. We're expanding that to not only the sort of our closest folks, but if you want to be on that list, we'll put you on that list. So interact with us, send us what you think. And of course, we want to thank you for listening. And as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.